Okay, my name is Chance Grable. It is July 1st, 2016. We're here in the Presbyterian Church in Hudson, New York, and I'm here with Quentin Cross. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Quentin Cross, and I am a lifelong resident of Hudson, and I am the founder and executive director of the Staley B. Keith Social Justice Center in Hudson, New York. And our space is located in the First Presbyterian Church. Yeah.
Do you want to tell me what it was like growing up here?
Growing up in Hudson, it was fun. And I really enjoyed my time growing up. I never had like a thought or an urge to want to live somewhere else, or it was close enough to the city, close enough to Albany, close enough to everything that I wanted to do. I had a really, fairly well childhood. I'm the youngest of six, so and I have some older brothers and sisters, and there's a gap, so like 6-7 year difference between me and my next sibling. So by the time I was 12, I was like home, and everyone else was off to college, and my mom was working in Albany, New York. I don't know, at that time. If not at that time, certainly. No. She was at the very least working. So she wasn't around during like the day. And then, yeah. So I also got in a lot of trouble during those times. But I don't consider those bad times. It's just that I was able to run a little wilder than most. Ironically, because I had an employed parent. So, yeah. Hudson had, like, when I was growing up, I had, like, all these stores, and they had all the box type old school stores. On Thursday nights they would light up the city, and then all the stores would be open late, and people would like stroll and meet each other and all those types of things. Yeah, I'm still close friends with the same friends that I had growing up living in Bliss Towers and the projects. So I wouldn't trade it for nothing.
What was school like for you?
School was difficult for me. This is one of the reasons that led me to get in a lot of trouble. Because the work wasn't all that challenging. And I just, I sort of want to be there. I was always, from a young age, I felt as if I was a targeted, because I was, a troubled youth, so to speak. I could have been considered a bad kid growing up. I didn't have the same type of respect for authority. But mostly, for me, as I look back at that time and where I'm at now, it was, I didn't have respect for white supremacy, and what they were trying to indoctrinate us with in the school setting. So I did my own thing. So So at like 14 years old, I got placed out of home. And I did my little time and then came back and I don't know, I excelled. And I was embraced by that particular, by my school district, because I was a young black man who had turned his life around, but could contribute to, I guess, their high standing, their standing, like a cog in the wheel, their numbers wise, their rates, so to speak. I was a kid of color who could excel. But it's different to see how they treated me as a youth and then as a, like a little kid, a little tyke, to as a teenager who, like, applied himself and wanted to do the best that I could to, in order to go to college. So, as a tyke, they rejected me. As a young adult, a teenager, they embraced me. And that made a difference. So, yeah, that's how my schooling was. Had some good teachers, but mostly I was just, I was not happy growing up until I got into 10th grade. Probably being in that school setting. I actually left at one point. I went to private school. It's a Christian private school. And that was interesting. I got paddled a lot. I got paddled until I had my growth spurt. And I wouldn't allow it anymore. And that was that. That was that chapter in my life. Faith Christian Academy. Yeah.
Do you think that this awareness that you have that they were sort of using you as a to boost their reputation as a school, was that something you were aware of at the time or that you realized later?
I was aware of because they didn't treat me like that previous to me coming home and excelling. So I knew what was going on. I also got into a lot of trouble then, but because I was excelling, it didn't matter. So I guess that's where a little bit of my privilege came in. Yeah.
You mentioned that you were not, that you were not, into their, what you referred to as indoctrination, and you wanted to do your own thing. Is that something that you were sort of thinking about then, or just sort of is something you've come to understand now?
It's something I've come to understand, but I knew I didn't want to hear about the first thing. Well, I didn't want to learn about black people through a lens of slavery. You know, I didn't want to hear about Christopher Columbus's discovery of America. That was prevalent in my life. I just didn't buy it. And I was, you know, a youth who, like, even in my, you know, from a little kid in church, like, we, like, were taught black history. We had to do black history assignments and all those things in the church house. So it's not like I wasn't getting educated at home. So, yeah.
Do you think that was a representative experience for African-American people going to school, or was that more particular to your experience?
I think it, in many ways it was representative. I can say, like, it was, at that time, this place was, like, breeding through the school-to-prison pipeline like no one's business. So I will say, like, I also have been incarcerated, and And just looking at my friends in that trajectory of the space we were in and the places we lived, which was, you know, Bliss Towers, Columbia Apartments, Skylar Court Terraces in that area, which is the public housing. Like, I was the last one to go to prison, and I was like 20, I was at 25, but everyone else was like on their second bid, and we all were in like the same grade. We all started kindergarten together. We all can't be that bad. It's just not humanly possible, in my opinion. So I look at it as a, the school at one point of a place that breeded despair rather than hope and achievement. A district that actually applied more pressure on you once you became of age, and basically made that environment so intolerable that you would drop out. And then what happened when you drop out? You go start, you know, getting into trouble, selling drugs, you know, doing whatever you're doing because you have idle time on your hands. So yes, that's how I look at it.
Do you see that as a generational experience?
Well, for me it was, because my father was incarcerated also. But my father's not from Harrison, North Carolina. But yeah, I do see it as a generational experience. But I also feel like it's incumbent upon us to break that cycle, you know, and that's one of the reasons I begin the work of the Social Justice Center. Because I looked at my life and looked at the fact that they always say, once you get in, it's hard to get out. Like, you go into prison and come home, and then it's all these minor things, but you're still, like, engaging with the law. And it's like, when is enough enough? And as I look at my life and look at the access that I had, having gone to prison, like, for misusing my public office, I've had a different experience than what most have, because I still have a certain level of access that affords me, like, assistance where most of my friends and people I grew up with don't have. So if I, you know, when I got in trouble, like, I had one of the best lawyers in the whole state of New York. And still to this day have that person. And, you know, it's because of relationships. Someone knew someone who knew somebody. And now today it's just like I'm surrounded by lawyers. Although I'd live a different type of life. I live a different life. I live a life that's meaningful to me. But I have these lawyers who, you know, are at the ready to support me in anything that I do, where most people have to deal with these public pretenders or, you know, all these systems folk who are in it for them to just keep defeating the system. So yes, it's generational. When you go to these courts around here, because the county is so small, it's only like 62,000 people, you know, these judges have been judges or DAs or this one or that, you know, court appointed. Look, so they know everyone, you know, they know the families. Sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad, you know. Hopefully most times it's in the middle. Right. Yeah. That's how I see that.
You said it's on us to change the cycle. Who do you include in that? Us?
I believe it's those of us who have been in it. I believe we've it's what we call a credible messenger model. Those who have been touched by the criminal justice system or in the criminal justice system or have had family incarcerated, it's incumbent upon us to take up the torch and help and assist in our community. By reaching out, being a mentor, or being a court watch advocate, or, you know, showing up at meetings and advocating, or just being a presence in the schools, or running for public office, or serving on a school board, so on and so forth. Working in these positions, that's what we do at SBK. We provide opportunities for Black youth and families to become leaders through community service, empowerment, and leadership opportunities. So yes, we have elected two people to the city council, a person to the school board. We have people in strategic locations as like home to school coordinators, which is that link between the community and the school district. So when a kid, you know, is facing difficulty or is at risk of being placed or having some law enforcement intervention, this person is there to serve as the buffer, looking for community resources, but also being an advocate to the district on what's occurring in that kid's life. And that makes a difference. You know, one of the first cases we dealt with was a young man who was, they were trying to put on a PINS, which is person in need of supervision, but it is the beginning of the school-to-prison pipeline in New York, because of the fact that they don't have dedicated, they have PINS under the criminal justice and not the human service side. So if you're on PINS, although you're a juvenile and it's all about, they say it's all about resources, you get a probation officer. Probation officer is not a human service person. They're law and order. So you get this probation officer, and before you know it, you're placed. This kid was going to be put on PINS because he was tardy to school every day. And they didn't quite understand, like, why is he tardy? We're talking to the family and things of that nature. Well, he was living with his aunt because his mom had, like, found a boyfriend and got up and moved to Florida, and he didn't want to go. But his aunt, who was a state worker but worked overnight, she didn't get home till 8:30 in the morning. What do you expect? So if that's the person who took it upon herself to take him in and is working till 8:30 in the morning, what is she supposed to get off at 7:30 to make sure he's up? When she has a whole house full? No, that's when I believe the system should have intervened and said, okay, we're going to, you know, put these things in place so that we can help them get up or help them be to school on time. Because we know you're doing all you can. You're raising your four kids and you took them in. You know, you're not in trouble. You're working. You know, where's the humanity there? So those are the types of things that we engage in. Bridging the gap of social distance, bringing people together, having, you know, crucial conversations around race, around, you know, housing. We did a couple years ago, we did a workshop with Oral History Summer School on housing as a human right, which it is. And let's have those conversations. Let's come together. And then when you bring people into these spaces, you find out many of them are going through the same thing. So now we're a powerful force, because even the newer people who have just come to town in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years or whenever they came, they're being crunched out too. So how do we become a mighty force for change? So that's how I see it.
You mentioned in school you felt like it was a white supremacist space. How did it feel then going into the city government, which in many ways is tied to the school, right? Isn't somehow there's some?
No, not in our. They're separate entities. They have their own subpart or subdivision. They're their own elected entity.
Okay.
But you still advocate and so on and so forth. Going into politics, it was, you know, I just ran right out of high school and didn't expect to win, and I won. It just happens.
Mm-hmm.
And I excelled. Within a year and a half, I became the majority leader, the third in command of the whole city. I excelled because I had people who believed in me. And at the end of the day, I use one basic premise whether right and wrong, for the most part, because I was not only, you know, 30 years most people's junior on that council, I came from the most impoverished ward. And at the end of the day, as I talked to the machine, the political leaders and all that, I could stand in my integrity and in my blackness, knowing that not only do I only need black people to vote for me, these are people who are born and raised in with. So it's a whole different ball game. So I stood in my blackness, I stood in my power, and it made a huge difference. And I was able to accomplish many, many, many things. Especially once I learned that that my voting base was the base vote for any member of the Democratic Party to win citywide. You know, once you figure that out, the ball's in your court. And, you know, there's, for the most part, they have two black areas, but black people and people of color are spread all around. So, you want me to campaign with you, even in your areas. I don't even want you to come in my area. I lose votes, let's be honest. So it worked out. So knowing that, and it didn't take very long to identify and understand that. Actually, when I ran, there was the former mayor, and he had served, like, when I first ran, like 7 terms. I was like, this is the first time they're letting me in their houses, you know? I bet, you know, but it's not just me. My mom served on the city council. My uncle was, he's the first black elected to the county board of supervisors. He's still there, you know, 25 years later, you know. So it's not like I didn't have a context on which to look at and draw from. It was very, very interesting. Yeah, just learned the system, and I guess I got sucked in a little too deep. But it worked out. It worked out. You know, so, and that was like 10 years ago, 2006. So it's like 10 years now, and I'm actually running next year for my uncle's seat, so it's, and I have the support of the party and everything, so it's very interesting to see how this all circled around, but more interesting to, and it gives me confirmation in the work that I do. Do you know any other felon who, like, leaves and messes up in a way that I did, which is like violating public trust, but 10 years later could come back as if it doesn't exist and the party establishment support it? That's a privilege that I'm aware of, and why I do the work I do in social justice. Because if I can't stand up for anybody, who else will? You know, so, yeah.
Would you like to talk about, so you ran right out of high school. Mm-hmm. And in high school, you're used to, you know, older folks have a lot of authority over you, but then you had an equal position. I mean, obviously, there's other power dynamics, but technically, within the political framework, you had an equal position. Do you want to discuss, like, what that was sort of like?
It was tough, because I, like, for 3 years before then, I worked for the city's youth department. My mom had to help me get a job there, and I was, like, there as a young, you know, working the summer programs and the winter programs. I just had a nice little gig. And I went from working there to chairing a committee on youth and aging. So to, like, from working there till December 31st to January 1, becoming the oversight for my former boss and all of those folks at 18 years old, and to be despised. I beat, like, a rising star, you know, in their area, in there, and it was a white guy, and I'm like, how the fuck can you, like, represent us? And it was just that game they played. They, you know, it took a long time to get people of color, like, elected in their own areas, because they wouldn't run. So, this guy was like the last remnant of like white power, like representing a black district, and it was like really crazy. And like my church went against me, like they brought out all the stops against me, and by God's grace and by the people, I still won. And and this guy told me, he was like, the minute you like turned your petitions in, like he said he knew he was gonna lose. It was a nasty race too, and it was nasty in the sense that like they were able to like buy black institutions to oppose me and use that. But you know, there's a saying that me and some of my colleagues say, my close colleagues, that's a saying. It says, there ain't no fun when a rabbit got the gun. So I won. And, you know, another saying we say, everyone has to bow and kiss the ring. And, you know, it happened I'm smiling because it happened quicker than I thought. And they had to come back because that was their access into that. And it worked out. But they were so upset that I won and they didn't want me there. Although they didn't know me. Like, I don't know you. You live out, like, I'm from Bliss Towers. I'm not going out of the Bliss Towers area. So there's no way, like, I know you or I know your family. I didn't know any of these people in government, you know. But one thing about having youth, even if you don't have any common sense or no sense at all, you can run circles around somebody 50 and 60 and 70 years old, you know, without any type of training or knowledge. And what happened is I just ran circles around them, but at the same time, I believe like God like put some people in my life at that time who are still in my life, that have helped me in ways that these folks couldn't. So I was able to manage and have power and influence in ways that they couldn't. So I started in politics at 17 as a canvasser for Hillary Clinton's Senate campaign, her first Senate campaign. And that was successful, and I got to go to like all the inaugurations and do all those things, because in New York, they have like the whole state party, but then they have like the rural conference, which is all the it's like 41 upstate counties, and the chair of the Columbia County Democratic Committee, who lived in this county with, you know, where Hudson is. She was the chair of that, and then the executive vice chair of the state party, which means like all the officials run through the county because of her and because of the position she holds. So when I was at Hillary's inauguration, we were like in Madison Square Garden Theater. That was like the mock one. And I was walking through, and there was this black guy walking out, and they were like calling him governor. And I knew we didn't have a black governor, and we didn't get one till 2009. But I went over to him and I introduced myself. Hi, how are you? Like, I'm here. And he was like, my name's H. Carl McCall, and I'm the New York State Comptroller. And I'm going to run for governor. So I just said hi. I was enamored, like, this guy. Like, this was the first black person ever elected to statewide office. You know, first vice president of Citibank, deputy ambassador, first black president of New York City Board of Education. Like, I met him, and I, like, felt good. And then this was like in January, and then in August he came to our county, and I said, I met you. And he said hi, but he was like pushed me to the side. And then they called me up to give a speech because I was running for office, and I ran for office, and like I'm like giving my speech. He came back was like, if you win, I'm going to give you a call. Like, if you win, I'm going to go, like, all right, all right. And I won. And then Denise's birthday is in, like, December or something. And they, like, had a party for her, the county, whatever. And everybody came to kiss the ring. Like, and he came through. And it was like, I know you won. And we're going to be giving you a call to come to this thing in, like, February. So I won office. And then I took office January 1st of 2002, which was a gubernatorial year. And then in February, Valentine's Day of 2002, I get a call from this guy by the name of Kevin Parker saying the comptroller wants you to come to Albany and meet some people. And it was the New York State Association of Black, Hispanic, and Asian Legislative Incorporated and the New York State Council of Black Elected Democrats. So this guy who's now running for governor and became the Democratic nominee, like, took me all around and introduced me to, like, everyone in power. And if you know anything about politics or black power and black empowerment, he's from Harlem and a member of the Harlem Club. Like, so he was everything in those circles. So he opened up doors for me that I could, and actually became in leadership within a year. And even today, it's still like when I went to prison, he got me to a nice prison. It's just so amazing. He, like, always writes letters of references for me. He's now the chairman of the SUNY Board of Trustees, State University of New York. And then the assistant, Kevin, who called me, is like one of my best friends. And now he's the assistant Democratic leader in the Senate. So think about the trajectory in all that time, and you have these people and you have those folks who, like, look out for you, but also coming from an upstate community where it's just white people, you don't really see no black people in power, to have that lens and know, like, damn, like, no, they're, like, black people in power, deputy speakers and chairman of Ways and Means, and, like, you know, and that was the year I, like, met Charlie Rangel and the whole, like, I'm, like, a son of the Harlem Club, like, I'm, like, and that is, like, to come from upstate New York, that is, like, fascinating, and it also allows for access. So when things needed to be done, I had a little bit more access than those who've been there 20 years. And most of our stuff comes out of, like, most of the stuff we need would come out of Ways and Means or what have you, who's the chairman of Ways and Means, Denny Farrell from Harlem, who, you know, one of my first introductions, you know. So it's sort of like it worked out. And then I proved myself, and then they respected me. And many of those people I'm still very close to. I'm still allowed in the back room. And now I have my own team of folks who are in elected office. At 33, I can say, like, I have a team of people that I've been able to help get elected with my influence. And that's fascinating. Including the majority leader of the city council now, who's the chairman of the board for Stella B. Keith, from Harlem, who moved to Hudson. And we got her elected, so I'm really happy about that. And Alexis Keith, who's the vice chairman of the board. We named the organization after her father. She's elected. A couple weeks ago, May 13th, black woman decided to run for school board as a write-in, and we got her elected 2 days later. 2 days. And we made it happen. And that goes to the strength of community and coming together. And it also goes to our friends in Surge, standing up for racial justice, who are white allies who support the work that we do. And it's just amazing what we can do when we come together. And we don't have to agree on everything. We just have to create the space for us to show up and have those discussions. And for a very long time in the city, those spaces have not been created. A lot of people ask me why I'm aligned with like the old regime, and because there's so many new folks here, and I would say to that, you know, the new folks want me in a room, but they don't want my people in a room. And one thing you can say about me is I'm a stand-up loyal dude. I'm about my streets. I'm about my community. I know where I'm from. I know who I am. I know who raised me, who bred me, and fed me. Like, and it's Bliss Towers, and it's Scarlet Court, and it's the terrace. It's where I was running. It's where I could leave my daughters at and know they'll be safe. You know, I was with the group today. We were out, and we went for ice cream or whatever, and I had my windows down, and we walked in a place, and they're like, you're not going to lock your windows or shut your car. And I'm like, I don't have to. They know who car this is. And that's community. That's love. You know, I live on 5th North 5th Street. We don't lock our doors. We don't have to. Because we know what time it is. That's love. That's community. And why do you say that? Because at any given time, if I get a call right now, I'll go to the courthouse and stand for somebody when nobody else would, regardless of what they did. I'm going to give people the opportunity to get their community services. I'm going to advocate for their kids. I'm going to show up at Department of Social Services or Children's Services or Child Protective Services and advocate for the family and the kids. And if something was wrong, I'm going to work on advocating on that pipeline to get that kid back into the household as soon as possible. Because sometimes mistakes are made. And we need to go back and reevaluate ourselves and get the help that we need. But we're all about reconnecting the family, which have been torn apart through Rockefeller drug laws and through all this mass incarceration and through just white supremacy as is. You know, it's time for a change. That's just how I look at it, and look at the role that I play in my community. That drew me back. I had left my community to go work at in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, at Bard College, Simon's Rock, doing diversity programming and living over there and things of that nature. And I was not all that happy, but I was content. And I was content knowing that I just came in here once a month and ran a meeting and made sure everything was going. And then it just drew me back. And now I'm back, and I'm coming back as executive director on the 11th, and just to talk to all the people who are like, we miss you so much, and this is what happened. I'm like, really? And then you know that you do good work, you know that you're there. Yeah. Look at people like Tiquan, who was down at the Oral History Summer School program. We worked with us. That was our first kid who we worked with. And they were trying to place them, and we stood in the gap, and the court gave us the opportunity. And that young man graduated last Sunday. And they gave us that one opportunity 4 years ago, and he made it. No initial problems. And you stand there and you say, yeah, the work is great. Let's continue to do the work. It's about us. It's about community. It's just so fascinating. But I just don't know. I don't know. I don't know how to bring others to the cause and to the table. I just, you know, it's not about self. This is selfless work. So we have to, you know, I don't care about your tea parties and your dinner parties and all that. I'm not going anyway. My biggest problem in Simon's Rock was I didn't hang out with any of these people. I came home. I have family. I have things that I want to do. I want to sit at home and watch MSNBC, probably. You know, I'm going to read the Huffington Post and, you know, Global Grind and all that. I'm living my life. My moments are my moments. But I do want the opportunity for my neighbor or some of people in my community to cross those barriers and be able to sit down. Because that's what you need, you know. You got me. Listen, the minute I took my oath and sat down at the table, I became part of your little your class system from what I see, where my life has worked. I'm a part of it, you know. And, you know, it has not served me all that great, personally. But I'm definitely going to make it serve the community. But I love it. I love the fact that we at this organization started by three men in a barbershop every Thursday night, and it morphed into what we have now. And to look on Facebook and watch people like tag the mayor and say today, like, we have a park in the black community that doesn't have bathrooms. What's up with that? This wouldn't have been heard of like a couple of days, but it's just been complaining. Now people are going direct action. They're going out getting petition signatures this weekend. People are engaged, and it is like a beautiful thing. And I know they'll try, you know, they'll continue to try to stop it. They try to discredit me because I owe restitution, but they won't accept the money that I want to give. So, it happens. You just continue to work. And I made a couple payments. As we were negotiating, like, to give them $200 a month. So I have to pay like $13,000 left. And, there's a couple of things that's ironic about this. I'm going to say it on the record. First and foremost, like, they're pushing to pay restitution, but they don't know, like, under the law, the minute I pay the restitution, I'm eligible to run for public office. So most people, like smart people would just leave it alone, but they don't think, like, because they probably don't read the law. So that's one. The second thing is, and this is, like, the second time I tried to, like, enter into serious negotiations. This time, though, like, when I came and they're like, no, we want to go through your record and we want to go through your taxes and I'm like, stop it. But I was at a surge meeting, and then I have some people on my board, and I have some, you know, people who are resourced around me. But I was like telling this story, and someone who's very close to me, like, was like, okay, I'm just going to pay your restitution. And I'm like sitting there, and I'm like, okay. And then I was with that person like a couple of days ago. Whenever you're ready, just let me know. And I'm like, well, and it made me laugh, like, thinking about how, like, petty, you know, people have been in trying to not accept the money or keep it as the lasting issue over my head. And then how I've just been blessed and have these resources out there that also serve our community. These are people who are writing letters or showing up at court for our people and things of that nature. So I'm just grateful for that. But we still have more work to do in Hudson. We have to bring the gentrified and the gentrifiers together, because they're, like I say, ain't no fun when the rabbit got the gun. The rabbit's on them now. Like, rabbit's on y'all, because our footprint will not change because HUD housing is not coming down. So we're here, and we're going to be in these areas, and we're going to still have the majority control of these areas. Actually, I can honestly say, through the work of Majority Leader Garriga and others, we're going to enlarge the footprint, because that's what you do when you get in office. You create more affordable housing to keep your base, but not only because it's right, but to keep that base. There's some strategy that goes along with that. So, but I think there's compromise there. We can go for an income base, and that supports all of our people. Or we can do a mix, income, market, and moderate income, which covers everybody. So, but we need people at the table to have those discussions. Come on now. But I think we as a people of color, always sacrifice, always have a helping hand out, always willing to sit at the table and try to come to common agreements to others who feel like it's their fucking world and we're going to do what we want to do. And I have a saying for that too. Might not never. That'll never be me. It's never been me. It's never been in my DNA. So I'm always going to oppose, and I'm always going to challenge. And the fact of the matter is that I've had such a tough time in politics my first couple of years that there's nobody up there who knows more about the charter and rules and any. There's no one up there who knows as much as I do, because I was a young black kid facing 10 other people every day of the week, you know. So, and that's that has benefited the community, and we just want to keep growing and we want to do more. Yeah, that's all I have to say on the politics stuff.
You mentioned some people, or you feel like some people, they want you in your room but not your people.
Yeah.
But and you also mentioned how you have a lot of access to lawyers and different resources and stuff that a lot of people in your community don't have. So how do you relate to that experience of having access to things that people in your community don't have?
I just call it God's favor, and I keep it moving, because if I have access, depending on the circumstance, they have access. So it's not, listen, I'm not coming to you from my family. That's a cardinal rule that I had even in politics. You need a job, go find a job. You're not going to get a political job. We don't, you know, I'm not going to be beholden to the system. So if I'm going to a lawyer or going to these folks, it's always on behalf of somebody in the community. So in many ways they have the same access, and it's an easier ask for me personally. I don't have any holds ups about you. I need you to go to court for Johnny, you know, because that's what we do. But if it was personal, for the most part, I have a couple people who are personal folk that I personally deal with. I work, you know, and I worked hard. I, you know, been to juvie, been to prison. What else can I say? I went to college, got my bachelor's. I'm actually a SUNY Diversity Fellow. I'm doing my master's. I'm on the Governor's Regional Youth Justice Team. I'm a part of the Next Generation Leadership Conference of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Actually, I'm going on a national board of the Southern Leadership Conference on July 21st. Like, the organization that Martin Luther King founded, like, I put the work in. Like, I, you know, so to whom much is given, much is required. And I do that part, and then the blessings come. And I'm grateful. And I, all of that, I just pour back into the community. Like, I pour it right back in. So that's why, you know, maybe when I was younger, I would have been held up with it. But it's all how you use it. And I use it to build more leaders and more credible messengers and stuff like that. When you continue to build and create, as we say, like biblically, sow into someone, like continue to sow, you know, the good reapings come, and you're creating these leaders all around, and you get more and more people, and they're joining the movement, and they're bringing about change, and you get more and more people so that you don't have to do it. And for me, I'm working overtime to work myself out of this job. That's just my goal. I'm just working overtime to get out of it. Like, you know, that's what I'm looking to do, just to get out and just, you know, live my life and be able to support my kids and be around them more and to love on them, which I'm able, you know, I'm able to do. And providing opportunities, you know. I know what it is to go to public school. But I worked to send my kids to private school, to a free school, because it matters. Like, I don't have to, listen, I don't have to worry about my babies in terms of education-wise, because they're not being crunched to teach to a test. They're learning, you know, what social justice and activism really is. And intersectionality and identity, and really, you know, what bridging the gap of social distance means. But I want that for all our kids. I want that for all our kids. I continue to work, and I still have a, you know, I'm invested in this city. My mama lived here. I got brothers and sisters who live here. I need nieces and nephews, great nieces and nephews, cousins and godkids and everywhere in between. You know, I'm here. Like, we work and we're going to continue to work. That's how I see it.
What was it like when you got back from prison? When you came back, a lot of people probably would have been.
Well, I came back. It was rough, and then I caught another charge, actually. So then it was equally rough. They tried to say I burglarized City Hall after that. So it was rough. I came home. It was rough. I left and I went to rehab. When I came home, I didn't have a drug problem, but under New York State law, you have to go back to your county of commitment. And the only way to get out of your county of commitment is to, like, go into, like, a rehab or whatever. Most people don't know it, but I read everything. So that was my way out of Hudson and Columbia County. So I got out and I moved to Albany, and I was in Albany for a while. And then I came back, and then I was, like, going to go and teach in China for a while. And then I got caught up with, what should I say, I robbed. Burglarized City Hall, and oh my gosh, I'd like to go through that and that, like, craziness. And then I had a good lawyer, and the shit disappeared like in 2 weeks. But they had tarnished me like all through that time. And then from then on, I just built the organization. It's sort of rough. It was rough outside of my community. It's rough in the white community and, like, dealing with them. And even when I went to Simon's Rock, there was a guy there who was from Hudson and who was in politics there. They ran him out of town. He couldn't win his election. And, you know, he was, you know, slandering my name and then saying, I believed in him and I supported him. And, you know, they create these, their own realities. And I'm like, I'm talking to my boss. He was like, I told him he had to get over it. And I'm like, you know what? Fuck him. I don't even know him like that. Like, you didn't vote for me, so who the fuck are you? You didn't vote for me. Like, I understand, like, the whole concept of violating trust, but I fucking let my people down. Like, actually, the community went back 10 years once I left, because the rest of the motherfuckers who was sitting there asleep, they ain't woke, they're asleep. They just getting their little check, and they ain't standing up for nothing. They falling for everything. So that's what I feel bad about. I don't feel bad about you fucking people living on Warren Street. I don't know you. I never, you know, oh, you supported me where? You can't vote for me. Where do you support? No, you were a part of the team. You was on the same band. I went and campaigned for y'all. None of you campaigned for me. You know, but then now you're all butthurt and all that. Come on, stop it. So that's what the type of stuff that I have to deal with in this community. Like, you know, say that to the fucking people right now. Where they talk about where no bathrooms in the park was. That was the last thing that I did, which was that park. And y'all fucking didn't complete it, probably because I fucking went to jail and shit like that. So you got a half fucking done park with just a pavilion and some fucking swings and shit, when it was like a fucking $350,000 project. Where'd the money go? What did you do? Your priorities changed because you have nobody putting their fucking foot against your neck, which is what I did and what I'm going to do and continue to do. I let them down. Many opportunities wasted. Like, I look back and I say this, like, mind you, I was at that time, I was like battling addiction. I was like doing cocaine like crazy. My shit was crazy. Powder cocaine was like, that was like from like 16. I don't know. And just a note, no, like 17. I didn't drink a beer or do any drugs until I was 17. And it was with my fucking white friends. It wasn't with nobody in the hood. And that shit ruined my life. You know? Just a note. And then as I was doing drugs and politics, I was doing it at the white restaurant, the Red Dot, with all those fucking people. They weren't doing that at Savoy's. They weren't doing it at the black establishment, so stop it. So I, you know, I was battling, you know, the addiction like crazy. And, I just like fucked everything up, and I didn't even have to do it. I didn't have to, like, I was just using the credit card like it was my own and like covering it up. And that shit was just crazy. I didn't even have to do it. And, like, and then I'm, like, sitting in jail, and, like, so many things transpired that we could have been, like, I could have really assisted my people. And, but I wasn't there. But I, oh, man, I was in prison. Like, so, like, our senator, our congressperson, Kirsten Gillibrand, like, became a senator. Like, fuck, like, she's from Hudson. Like, I helped her get in. Like, if you go to her original petitions, I'm there on the committees on vacancy. Like, I'm, like, I was a crucial decision maker there. And we could have had that access. No one has that access with her. She's not doing shit for Hudson right now, but I would have made that happen. 2009, I'm fucking sitting in prison, and if fucking David Patterson becomes the first black governor. David Patterson had got Carl McCall's seat in the Senate. He was, I knew him, like, we were, you know, he was the Democratic leader, the highest ranking black person in the Council of Black Elected Democrats. I was the Mid-Hudson Regional Director. A friend, like, someone I know, like, that type of access to support the people. What the fuck? Like, I messed that whole package up for the people. So, I also feel like my penance is, like, doing this work and righting a wrong in this type of way. And we're gonna get there. We're gonna get there. No doubt in my mind. And as they continue to push and they continue to try to discredit us, and we just build and grow. We continue to build and grow. Every time I get a new position, like, that's building and growing for the whole community. And that don't happen by accident. We're doing the work, and you can't stop the work, and people can't stop the movement. And people get more and more fed up and more engaged. And even the sleeping politicians who are people of color, they'll tell you, if you were to run into them anytime right now, what did Quinn tell you the last election? Like, you better get yours before you come in. What happened? We didn't listen. We should have listened to him. Because I've learned. I learned that. I learned in politics. I don't want anything in the future. I want the right now. So if you can't deliver for the people right now, then there's no conversation. So I'm willing to get back engaged. I don't know if I really want to get back engaged, but I love politics, and I also know that in my district the voting turnout has gone down 150% since I've not been on the ballot, and that's a fact. And I'm wanting to re-engage my community, and a lot of it has to do with people who are running, who are like newer to the community or have been there long. It's still a good old boy town, though. It's something about, like, yeah, we know you, and okay, we'll vote, but we ain't really coming out to vote for you. It's something that's different from being generational. My great-grandmother, Leslie Stiles, and my grandparents, Bernie Stiles Cross and Edward C. Cross Jr., and then my mom and her generation, and then my generation, and then my kids' generation, and then my niece and them, and then their kids' generation. It's something generational that's different. Like, where the trust is that, like, you're not gonna break the family trust, you know, where, you know, like my colleague and my protege, Tiffany Gariga, like, she's in, but there's no family connection, like, in a way that where the trust will come, like, yeah, we can, it's not there. But people don't get that about Hudson. They don't get about the fact that a lot of white people always say, I don't know why they continue to believe in Quinn. I just don't understand it. You know, we just like each other. That's why we believe in each other. We've come through the same trials and tribulations and what have you. Again, let me tell you, I was 25 when I, like, went to prison. Like, my friends was on their second bed. Come on, let's talk about it. They were this the second time incarcerated. You know, some now are on their third and fourth time. So, and I always move with respect and humility. Courtesy and respect, I believe, are integral to doing the work. And, yeah, Hudson is a very interesting place to live and grow.
I just want to ask one more question and then we'll wrap it up. So what do you, it seems like criminal justice has been part of your life, you know, from a very young part, and that part of what an elected official does has some say, you know, obviously less at the local level. But so what did you see that as any part of your role? You'd already been incarcerated by the time you were in city government. Did that influence how you
Well, and I also was the chairman of the Public Safety Committee by the time I was 20 years old. I demanded that they move with courtesy and respect. I helped and presented the first black commissioner that the mayor appointed. We had a black chief who got his job through civil service. But just keeping a certain amount of respect that has been lost. But it's, people don't know how to wield the power appropriately. I knew how to wield the power. And during the time I was majority leader, I chaired public safety and legal. And in that vein, I was very clear with the leadership down there. Like, you know, you got to hit me 2 times. And I set the agenda. And if I feel as if you are disrespecting my community, not moving with integrity, courtesy and respect, we have some issues. And there was times when they didn't. And it was times when, you know, I had to cancel a meeting, or the resolution didn't make it, or, you know, okay, we're gonna different type of negotiations when it's time for contracts. It's okay, you know, because at the end of the day, if we want to talk about police in this city, first of all, none of them live here, so you can't vote. So fuck you. Can't vote here. Fuck you. Like, right? Let's be honest here, because that's what you're saying to our community most of the time. So you don't vote here. So I don't. Nothing you say matters. That's clear for me. People might feel like, as elected official, that's outrageous. But no, you're siphoning off millions and millions of dollars of the city's taxpayers' money, of these poor people money, and you living out in your houses out in the county, you know, up to 15 miles out of here. You don't get a say. And the second piece is that you serve at these people's pleasure. We all work for them. And when we lose sight of that, that's a problem. But that's why I work to raise the age of criminality in New York State right now. 16. We're trying to raise the ages to 18. That's why I do, you know, I'm on boards and commissions and I do this work. And we go into Rikers Island. We're in these facilities teaching people who are incarcerated. We want to give them a better start. I'm on the advisory committee for the reentry task force for this county and all that. We're just working, and I've lived it. I have lived experience. I'm a credible messenger, but I'm not as credible as all them brothers and sisters who had to get out and figure it out on their own by their bootstraps. I came out on a surfboard, really. Like, come on, let's be honest here. And I understand that. When I was in prison, I did a lot of crying, and I did a lot of crying around the fact that when you hear people's stories. And then I compare my shit, like, damn, I'm really a fuck up. These people had no chance. They had no hope. They came from straight fuckery. And, yeah. And this was destined for them. It wasn't destined for me. I created my own mess. So that's why I do it. And I help, you know, right now my board just approved, some additional work, this program called Empower. And what I want to do and what I'm doing is, you know, I hired my former correctional counselor as like the head of it. And we're going to get some of these guys who was in the prison I was in, and we're going to pay them stipends to go in and do this work in these prisons and whatever, because that's what I can do. That's what I have access to do in terms of getting funding and contracts and things of that nature. We're going to put these brothers back to work who want to. If you're in New York City, you want to go to Rikers Island, we got a stipend for you. Go on the island and give a good word and all over. And I'm looking to create a state network to have these people who are coming home, who are home and who are doing well, to get some facilitation training and to pay them stipends to go into these prisons and work with the young men and women, older, what have you. And that's off the ground now. So I'm really excited. So, anything else?
I think that's it. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.